Welcome to In the Arena. Today's one with a little bit of a difference. I've actually putting myself in the arena. I've got Andrew Horsfield, who's interviewed me, and I've been thinking about this for some period of time, whereby just to have the opportunity to probably give some of the more core pieces and fundamental pieces of thinking and philosophy around my approach to leadership, as much as anything, building on the experiences that I've had, but also the sense making since I've had the opportunity to coach it and think more deeply about it in regard to how I offer it up to other people. So I've really enjoyed this conversation. Andrew's a wonderful thinker on all things leadership as well, and he's got a terrific podcast, and definitely look that one up. But I am now putting myself in the arena and everything which actually comes from it. So enjoy.
Cam, welcome to your podcast.
That's wonderful. No, I really appreciate the opportunity of – I really enjoy being on your podcast. And when I come around to thinking about someone who I would like to be interviewed by, which is a little bit of a different thing in its own right, I thought of you straight away. So I really appreciate the opportunity of having this conversation.
No, thanks for putting your trust and faith in me. I thought you must have gone down the list of Denton or Lee Sales, or they just weren't available.
Yeah, no, but, they weren't available, but we didn't check.
Yeah.
So, no, it's great. No, and I think the fact that, you know, we're in a similar space in that we're all, you know, we're trying to meet people where they are now from a coaching perspective. And I think if the one thing I've learned from being on, you know, the other side of the podcast, Mike, is your capacity to try and meet the person where the person's at. Mm. And I think that's almost, you know, sits at the very heart of the work we're certainly seeking to do. And I know that that's something that you'll endeavour to do, no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I've always enjoyed our conversation, so I'm looking forward to this one immensely. Tell me, I mean, you grew up in and around footy your whole life. Was that always, as a young child, your aspiration to be involved in footy, or were there other things, you know, as a young Cameron that interested you as well?
I don't think it was ever an aspiration, because I just always saw it as something which would have been beyond me in that way, that I thought it was that somehow the people in the game were these special people, you know, and my father being one of those, and he was held in very high regard. So I was always loved the game, and I, you know, often say I think I fell in love with the game before I fell in love with anything else. But because of the way that I grew up, there was a real sense of these folklore figures around the sport, of which, you know, I might be, you know, I was happy to sort of bask in their reflected glory a little bit. And then the other thing I probably experienced growing up mostly as a reflection was certainly the sport and its capacity for brilliance, for bringing out the very best in people, and, you know, marvellous acts of athletic, you know, brilliance in that way. But also saw its capacity for lousy as well. Mm-hmm. And I choose the word lousy, you know, quite deliberately, because I saw it bring out the worst in people as well. And I think it was probably getting the full experience of that growing up, and made for a relatively, you know, colourful and complex way of living, in particularly in our household. But there was always a sense that somehow we were living something far more interesting in our life, and it was just the perception of a child, obviously, than what, you know, my mates down the road were, or the kids I went to school with. But then over time, the game grew, and as the game grew, more opportunities opened up for people who just had an aspiration, perhaps work in the sport. Because when I'd go into my father's work, Alan Schwab, and he was almost the only person working there, and Richmond winning premierships at that stage. And so it didn't look like there was obvious career opportunities, you know, when there's only one person working there, you know. And I think over time it came two or three. And by the time I came into the sport, almost in an office boy type role, was I think we might have had 11 or 12 people working in the place. So it was starting to open up a little bit as the game became more professional. And once I was in an organisation, which was the Melbourne Football Club, I saw, you know, the possibilities become there for me.
Yeah, but before we jump into those possibilities, tell me more about that formative experience of seeing the real world of leadership, of both the good and the bad, or the lousy and the terrific? What?
Yeah. There's heroes in the game, you know, players who can just do remarkable things, and players who were seen as having special talents, if you like. But from a behavioural point of view, you would often, the game was very forgiving of what you would consider just poor behaviours. And, you know, in the way people were treated, I can recall as a young person being almost the fly on the wall in match committee meetings after games, where, you know, the list of names would be up on the board, and it would just be a blackboard in those days, you know, held up by a little bit of, you know, ankle strapping tape or something like that. And they'd be basically working through the list of Richmond players. And by the end of that meeting, you know, three of the names would have a line through them. And my dad would then take out his little Spirex notebook, and his requirement that day or that evening was to try and find those players and tell them that they were no longer playing for Richmond. You know, they might have played that day, you know, in the reserves or something like that. And so we'd drive home, he'd drop us off, and then he'd be in his car trying to find them. And, you know, you'd be reading during the week that they're now playing for another AFL club, or they've gone interstate, or, you know. And that was just part of the deal. That was the expectation. And it was almost the lack of sort of care, I think, you know, probably. It didn't strike me at the time. I just thought that's how it was. Mm. Yeah, but over time you realise there's no excuse for those behaviours, but it was just how it was. And also just even, you know, seeing some of the aspects of the social behaviours of people and how forgiving the game was of those if, you know, the player could play.
Mm.
You know, that you just – the treatment of, you know, women around sport – I can remember as a young person being in the change rooms of the Richmond Football Club, and I might have been 9 or 10 years of age, and the old MCG used to have a driveway, used to go around the outside of it. But in the middle of winter, you'd come out of the change rooms, and, you know, the players had been there for, you know, after game, they might have been there for hour and a half, and the wives and girlfriends were just waiting on these concrete or this bitumen area in the wet and the cold, all huddled up, waiting for their, you know, their boyfriends, their husbands or whatever to walk out. And, you know, and my mum would be one of those people, you know. And they'd been just sitting around in a cold, wet driveway basically waiting for them. Whereas, you know, I was a 10-year-old kid as a boy able to get into the rooms, but the women weren't,
yeah.
You know. It was those things. And they're mainly as a reflection, by the way. I can't say that I had any insight into those things at the time, but they're certainly things which I now reflect on and know that as much as we're always on a journey of trying to make things better, you know, that's the context from which it actually emerged from.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. What's your take on that around? Are leaders setting the context, or are they working within that context and so it's acceptable because, okay, well, that's just the way the world is, or is it our responsibility as leaders to be setting and changing that context and making it better?
Yeah, I think it is to make it better. And there's always this idea of, and I heard Nathan Buckley talk about it at one stage, and he was talking about the way of which he was recruited, and it was, you know, the brown paper bag of cash, and, you know, and it was in a podcast, and they were laughing about, you know, imagine if that happened today. And he made a statement that he said, look, I think sometimes we're between the old way and the new way. We're stuck between the old way and the new way. And or we may land somewhere between the old way and the new way. And then he paused for a minute and he said, no, we're always in that place. We're always in that place. And I think our role as leaders, whenever in doubt, go the new way. There are a lot of forces, because nostalgia is such a powerful aspect of identity and who we are, and, you know, and clearly the world's going through a lot of this at the moment, you know, in that sense that somehow our old world was greater than our new world. And, you know, whenever you talk to people about, you know, when did they enjoy music most, when did they enjoy sport most, I can almost guarantee it was when they were in their late teens, early 20s, or some formative period of their own growth, when they were falling in love with something. And, you know, that's why, you know, there's soundtracks to our lives, which we then, you know, music's a unique sort of art form in that it's you can have it on repeat and still be okay with it. You know, yeah, it can be just a consistent part of it. And I think there's – so nostalgia being such a powerful thing, but, you know, leaders need to certainly have a sense of, you know, where we've come from, the so far story, but really it's building the not yet story. And the not yet story is normally one of, you know, of becoming, of getting better, of but at the same time creating ideas around belief and belonging and those things, which may be actually in part from the so far story, you know, and sport's very strong on that. You know, if you align yourself in, say, the work that I did, you know, as CEO of Melbourne Football Club, well, it was the originators of the game itself way back in 1858. So the so far story's as good as any in world sport, really, the only sporting club in the world still playing the game that it invented. But it can't stay in that place. Mm. You know, it builds on that sense of folklore and that nostalgia, and, you know, the we stand on the shoulders of those who have gone before us. But the courage is informing the new way. So I often say to leaders, whenever in doubt, go the new way. And a new way with all of its uncertainty and all of the lessons that no doubt it will bring in your efforts to try and form it.
That's one of the challenges of leadership, isn't it? To I mean, in a leadership role, you mentioned about people needing to be better or move into that new opportunity. But particularly in footy, but it's the same as any business that's got a story to it. There's a history, and there's past people who have put blood, sweat and tears into getting to a place. So how do you balance that as a leader between respecting the past and moving or pushing into the present?
So it's respecting the past for what we believe the past gave us, but it's also not dogma. It's not, you know, look, there's been enormous growth in the game. For instance, women have now got the possibility of a career path in the sport as athletes in the game. That's something which has now been available, and it's still unformed. It's just forming as we speak now. But that was something which was available for 150 years, but it's only happened now. And so, what was that? Why didn't that happen? You know, and it was some basis of dogma that we saw that people would have no interest in watching women play football. It was just – that was really what it was held back by. And those who were committed to the sport were the most courageous who have ever been committed to the sport, because every aspect of their love of the game was actually met with that force against them, that it was prejudice, that they were mocked, you know, they were made fun of. There's been no aspect of my love of the game or the love of the game by anyone who's played it from a men's perspective, which was ever met with that. But women have been. And so just even the most basic reasons why you would play a game was met with those, that mocking response. And it wasn't until really that I realised it was men like me who were the actual problem here, because I'd grown up in that environment. I'd carried forward that bias. I'd carry forward that dogma. And, you know, Debbie Lee, who's been a guest on this podcast, it was the courage of people like that who then and happened to be get to know her and got close to her and realised that she was the most courageous football person I'd ever met for that reason. And often it is the act of singular courage, if you like, which then becomes the and she would never say it was her on her own. There was certainly a wonderful collective of people at that time who then had the force to change the sport in ways that the sport didn't realise it could be changed. And that's what I think leadership looks like, you know. So it builds on, you know, the history and almost the, you know, the more recent history of women's sport, that the wonderful folklore of those courageous people being in reach of those who are now playing the game. They can actually, you know, they can be at events, they can go to games, and they can, you know, if you're a 19, 20, 21-year-old, you know, athlete playing Australian football, as a female, you can actually, you know, put your hand out and thank the people who have made it possible for you. Mm. And I think that is almost the perfect example of great leadership.
Yeah, Can you give us an example for your, from your own leadership experience of working through that process of a decision?
Yeah.
From your own experience?
Well, I think probably that one was, yeah, that we saw a possibility in the game that perhaps others hadn't, not because the game was not wanting to, or perhaps there was aspects of it not wanting, but because they just hadn't had the access to it that I was fortunate enough to have, and we saw the possibilities because of that. And all we did really was, it was a very simple one. We just had an exhibition game, which was initially it was a metropolitan team playing a country team, you know, the best athletes in Victoria. We played it at the MCG. And then all of a sudden I saw something in it a little bit, and we encouraged it to go another level. And Melbourne Football Club was the oldest club in the competition. Why wouldn't we be the first to have a female team? And we played a game, you know, 12 months later against the Western Bulldogs, and then the world saw what we'd seen. And so what it tells me is that the world's always giving us feedback in one way or another. You know, you're in conversation with someone, there's feedback. You read a book, there's feedback. You go into an environment where you seek feedback. Sport is great at feedback, you know. You can always get better at it, but it's actually embedded in the process. And the feedback's not always good, by the way, because there's a lot of people who do have opinions on it, often in a relatively unhealthy way. But the feedback, and we actually responded to that feedback, and the experiment we had then made that feedback available to other people who have probably had their hands on the levers that we didn't have, in this case the AFL, and within 4 years we had a national competition, and that's how quickly it happened. And I think probably over time the creativity of leadership for me was my mother's an artist and I was always someone who did art, but somehow I saw the creativity, you know, the making things part of myself as something separate to what I did as a leader. But then when I reflect mostly on the things that have given me the most joy and perhaps that little bit of pride, and there's a healthy pride and an unhealthy pride if we're not careful, is the things where we made something, we created something. Someone having enough courage with their imagination to force a different way of thinking. And I saw that with my father, because my father was really in many ways with another group of people the architect for the national competition for things like salary caps and things like drafting. And, you know, we've got teams in, you know, Sydney, Queensland, South Australia, Western Australia, through the force of, you know, the collective vision, but my father was one of the architects of that vision. And I would never, I thought of my mum as an artist, as a creative person. I never thought of my father as a creative person, but no doubt he was.
No doubt he was.
And it's the creativity and the courage to go with that.
So two questions there. You label your mother as an artist, but you're someone who does art. Is there a difference that
it's a good pick up. It took me a long time to say I was an artist. Yeah. So I studied art full time, and so by any definition that made me an artist, yeah. And you wake up in the morning thinking about what you're going to make that day as an artist. Well, clearly that makes you an artist. Doing something, and it's interesting because I often talk to this in the process of the work I do, as in even I can be in a room full of leaders and I go, how many people think of themselves as a leader, you know, and people are almost reluctant to put their hand up, but they've got titles as CEO, you know, so it's, you know, it's bringing that sense of the who, the identity to what you actually bring as a leader. Yeah, so it was a great pickup. No, I do think of myself as an artist.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Because you obviously are. I mean, people would know your work and had seen your work. How does that creativity help form your leadership philosophy, and not just in the work that you do with other people, but in your own work for yourself?
No, it's a great question. And Belinda's here now, and I've spoken recently, and it was a little bit of a I've heard people speak about this idea before, but I And I knew that there was a possibility that I was falling for it, which is this idea of the paradox of your expertise or the paradox of your knowledge, where you've built certain understandings and insights which you now coach and teach, but you're not actually bringing them back, you know, to yourself. You know, the carpenter whose cupboards are falling off, the kitchen cupboards are falling off, or the doors are falling off. And so I gave a lot of thought. It was in quite a reflective, introspective time, and in terms of the work I now do with leaders, and what is the thing which is actually, you know, the difference, you know, the thing that would be I'm happy to put out there as a way of people selecting, in fact, whether they would like to work with me or work with someone else. And I'd often say to people, say if I'm coaching, I go, well, if you want coaching, I'm not the right coach for you. That doesn't mean you don't go and find yourself the right coach in that sense. So the two words which came to mind for me were creativity and humanity.
Mm-hmm.
They were the two words, creativity and humanity. So the creativity, and often you know, again, the same question I would ask of leaders in a room, how many people in the room think of themselves as creative? And people, those who are in some definition of it, which is some identity given to them rather than the one they have of themselves, is someone to put the hand up and say, look, yeah, I play the piano. Yeah, or I, you know, I used to draw when I was a kid or whatever it might be. But then if you actually say who in the room has to come up with innovative solutions to challenging issues, well, everyone puts their hand up, you know. So that's clearly a form of creativity. But then you actually say, regardless of who you are at any time, you only ever bring one imagination into the room, and, you know, whoever you are. Our role in all of this is to actually somehow draw on the collective imaginations of those who are actually in the room as our role of leaders. So to actually even go into those spaces with certain leaders is a little bit uncomfortable, because often there is sort of leader as hero and we've all, you know, riding on your white horse as the person with all the answers. Well, what you're immediately doing is constraining the possibilities in that sense. And that's why I love the Rick Rubin idea of your idea, best idea. We want people to bring their idea into the room in order to get to best idea. So that's where the creativity piece comes into it, that strategy by definition is a creative pursuit. You know, it's looking at something which isn't happening and trying to turn it into something which could happen, you know, and then in our efforts to make it happen, we get the lessons and the learnings and the feedback of trying to make it happen. And then, you know, we now get the benefit of that thing. And the humanity piece.
Before we jump into the humanity piece, there's sitting in a blank piece of paper for an artist into that first line that you have to then spoil the piece of paper is sort of part of that.
Yeah, nothing more. Yeah, the term they often use in art, nothing more intimidating than a blank canvas.
And putting that into that leadership or team space, there is that. Okay, I've got to share my view. I've got to not sure how this will land. Or it's a courageous step for any person or team to be able to have that conversation. How do you foster that in as a leader in teams? Mm. Do you have strategies and structures and frameworks that you like to use to get more of that out in teams?
Yeah, no, it's a great question again. The first thing I'd say is that if there's one thing that leadership's going to ask of you, it's going to be courage, you know, the bravery piece. And people, you know, and we're not – the good thing is we're probably growing up in a generation now where ideas around vulnerability are spoken of, and people say vulnerability as in sharing your story and all that, and I get that because that's good from a connection point of view and that's important, no doubt. But the vulnerability, the most vulnerable place a leader can actually find themselves in is the place of not knowing,
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of my favourite lines, and people have heard it on the podcast, you've never led unless you've woken up in the morning, your first thought's fuck. Well, that normally is the not knowing piece, you know, in that sense. And you're going to have to somehow come up with something in that not knowing, or it's worse than not knowing. It's actually knowing and thinking it's not going to be very good here. We're going to get a bad outcome. And so the vulnerability is to be able to come into the room and say, I don't have the answer, but I'm confident it's in this room. And so therefore create the conditions in that room for that. And the idea, I talked just quickly about that, your idea, best idea, is a key thing that I coach too, that the people in the room, and the concept we talk about is come to play. They do come to play. You've got to create the conditions where leaders come to play. And so the people in the room, they come into that room with at least an idea as it relates to the thing that we're trying to sort, we're trying to work out here. And you create the conditions as leader for people to feel okay about expressing that idea. And the idea is likely to be expressed in a really unformed way because it's just an idea. It's not a solution, it's just an idea. And then hopefully there's enough ideas out on the table that we can actually form what we consider the best idea at this point to go forward with. And that best idea might still be wrong. And it might also be, as leader, you have to actually land that. You can't do some democratic version of everyone's idea. Mm. You have to say, I'm going to use a bit of this, a bit of that, or you might even still go with the idea that you had in the first place and say, I've heard what you've said, I'm going forward with this idea. And then you might go forward with this idea and history will say, well, you were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And at least what we've got is now the feedback of getting it wrong that actually now informs what we have to do next in that sense. So embedded in that process, the vulnerability piece is the not knowing, but then the not knowing, the vulnerability, there's no vulnerability without courage. There's no vulnerability without bravery, you know, and that's in any form. You know, playing the sport itself, playing Australian football, and you're a cricketer. The most vulnerable I've ever felt was facing someone who was seriously quick, you know, in cricket. Often, even at the nets in training.
Yeah,
you'd probably relate to that. Yeah,
you know, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And you go, well, what's it asking of you? Bravery.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get in line. You know, it's, you know, the very first thing you're told as a young fella, aren't you, when you're facing someone seriously quick, can you get in line, you know? And what you're doing is basically putting your body in a place where it can get hit.
Yeah. There's a great Bluey episode about that. I don't know if you've seen it. Yeah.
No.
About exactly that, you know, get behind the ball. You can either get hit or get behind it and hit it for six, you know? And so as a cartoon, it
well, you can't hit it for six, mate. Although the way you can actually now hit a six without getting behind it, it's actually cricket has changed a fair bit. Yeah. But it is, you know, again, that idea of any form of vulnerability, and people will talk about it. And even ideas around authenticity, where there's no authenticity without vulnerability, there's no vulnerability without bravery. That just that little line, I will experience you as an authentic leader if I can actually experience some part of your bravery. That's the only way I can. Yeah
and I love that perspective because I think as a leader there's two points that you're making. One is that improvisation nature, which comes back to the creativity that you're talking about, is how does your idea, rather than get rejected, how do I lean on that and then move that into something else that someone else picks up? So if as a team, if we can keep moving in and taking one idea and improving it or advancing it as opposed to just rejecting it, it creates that environment of everyone's got that say.
Yeah. Well, the improv is actually a great word because I don't think there's a more courageous artistic pursuit than improv, you know, in that sense. But they're also quite systematic, aren't they? People who are good at improv have learnt a system. So, like, it's not the process I'm talking about in regard to your idea, best idea. It's not without system. You know, then you need to create a system which actually, but part of that system is you creating a space of which people can now move into. It's, in my experience, spaces which are created in that way, good things happen. Spaces which are just left behind because you haven't confronted or you've got lazy or you've lacked bravery, whatever it might be, generally fill with negativity.
Mm.
You know, the sort of the lazy spaces, you know, in that sense, or the ones, as I mentioned, with, you know, without courage. But the ones that we create, there's a very good chance they can get filled with the right things if we bring the right mindset ourselves to that. But, you know, I don't know about you, but I just saw when I was growing up and I got to work with these, you know, these figures like a Ron Barassi or whatever, I just thought they would be these freaky geniuses who just walk in the room with all the answers. But they were just some of the most – he would to this day probably be the most curious person I've ever met in my entire life, you know. And he was curious in a relatively intimidating way, you know, as in he was a demanding curiosity. You know, if you had an idea, you'd want to be able to back it up, no doubt about that. But he was quite the opposite to what I thought he would be. You know, there was definitely a real persona about him, and you know, very charismatic. But he was an unlocker rather than an extractor. You know, he wanted to unlock creativity within, even in those days, you know, whereas most people would think of him as an extractor, you know, someone who stood up and demanded performance. There was a bit of that, don't worry, but it was mainly the unlocking.
Yeah, and that's what's celebrated publicly, isn't it? The big spray and the demand and the but it's great to hear another perspective about his leadership and who he was as a person.
Yeah, well, you felt loved by him. You felt connected to him. You felt, you know, there was a warmth and, you know, would, you know, but, you know, as I said, you'd want to be able to back it up. You know, it wasn't, you don't throw them from the cheap seats.
Yeah. Well, I was going to also say around that environment, I'd love to hear about when you say it doesn't come without system. So so what is a little bit of that you create in your work to enable a team to be able to do that? And maybe somewhere in there, if it's not a double-edged question, I think the element of what you mentioned about sometimes as a leader it's I've heard everyone but I'm doing my own thing and it doesn't go well. There's a chance to build a team with that too through that vulnerability and authenticity of saying, hey, this decision was mine, I think I missed this, as opposed to, or having that personal responsibility as opposed to being justified or pushed away. That difficult moment is often the grindstone of leadership, isn't it?
It is, and you know, there's and I can't remember where I heard this, but there's a certain cost to leadership, like personal cost. And one of the first, and as soon as I heard it, I related to it, was this idea that as leaders we're going to be judged, often unfairly, and never be given the opportunity to fully justify ourselves or explain ourselves. And so our capacity to operate with that, which by definition feels unfair, and if you're signing up for leadership, you're not signing up for fairness. But probably life's like that anyways. We know one of the beautiful lines, you know, that I heard from Neil Danaher, as you know, started off as a letter to his grandson Cooper when he was, you know, when he first, you know, received the heartbreaking news he had motor neurone disease. Was in this letter, he says, Coops, life's good, doesn't promise to be fair. Life's good, doesn't promise to be fair. And being okay with that, because the danger is the response to the lack of fairness is we go to a place of blame. You know, we blame others. And blame, I would say, and I've fallen for it, is definitely a below the line thing, because it offers no solution and attracts a crowd. And so your capacity to stay above the line in that sense is, even at that time when you're feeling that the world has treated you in the most unfair way, is, you know, and using a wonderful brassy term, requires you to be a little bit better than human nature. And so the great people are a little bit better than human nature. There's some part of their human nature that they've, you know, that they've been able to, you know, push back, grow from, whatever it might be. And so therefore that getting it wrong is all it is a new point of departure. If there's people in the room who are going to judge you on that basis, given if you've created the conditions whereby we've bought in on the decision, because it wasn't, when we leave the room, it's not about agreement. We don't agree. We just align. Are we going to align to the decision that we're taking here? Yeah, we are. Did we agree with it? Of course we didn't, because it's not your idea. It's not your opinion. And then when we come back and go, well, guess what? It didn't work out. But if nothing else, we've learned from it and we've got a new point of departure as to what we do now. And that's okay. If you've got people who want to push against that, well, it seems to me that's actually more about them than it is about the team. And you might have some coaching to do. You might have some work to do. And ultimately, if it becomes a repeating pattern from that member of your team, well, you've got a decision to make. You're either in or you're out.
Mm.
And so that goes to the second part of the cost of leadership, is you'll often have to make decisions which on people's lives, for people who you care about, which will affect them in a negative way. You know, you may cost someone who you like their job. And the third one is you'll be disliked.
Mm.
You'll just be disliked. And that's part of it. And in a world where likes has become a thing, you know, being disliked is and I can still run into people who, you know, because the world you mix in, and I know that person dislikes me because of a choice I made in regard to their life. And it mightn't be just them, it will be their partner, it will be even their kids, because their career didn't continue the way they hoped.
Does that impact you still, or is part of how you see leadership as the cost, as you say?
Yeah, no, it still impacts. But you just got to front up in that sense. And if you go into avoidance, well, again, that's saying a little bit more about you than them. You know, and again, I will see people that might be 20, 30 years later where you made a choice that they wouldn't continue as a player with your club, because I was in recruiting at the time. And, you know, and a 17 or 18-year-old ambition was just cut off at that point. And you're now talking to a middle-aged man who still harbours that. And I think if I was that person, there would be part of me still harbouring it. And the interesting thing, because I've had decisions made for me on my career, clearly, you know, to be appointed into roles and also to be dismissed from roles. And often you're the person who's the least informed person, even though you're the subject of the choice to actually, you know, there might be 15 people who know more about the reason I was sacked than what I'll ever know, you know, that you only get the bit that they've decided to tell you.
Tell us about that. We've talked about that before, and I find that perspective you have really interesting around that.
Yeah, well, it's a big decision to sack a CEO. And you're just brought in and you're told you're sacked. And I never, in one case I wasn't even brought in and told I was sacked, but so that happened twice, so the second time I was. And they really couldn't explain it to me. And I think it was mostly because there was a sense that something needed to shift, and whilst I was in the role, the thing couldn't shift. I would like to think that they're probably underestimating my capacity to shift, but, you know, that was – and so I imagine that the conversations to make the choice, and I had a bit of a profile in the role and that was part of it, and it was going to be a big story either way, was a lot of people would have been involved in that, and a lot of conversations were had, and the decision was made that whatever I bring at that point is not what they need, and that someone else could bring something that they did need, but it could never be fully explained to me. And so there would be however many tens of conversations which would have happened, of which, you know, would have been in some cases, you know, was it based on fact or was it based on opinion? Was it based on whatever it was? And the first time it happened, it had a genuine, you know, effect on me, impacted me in a really deep way. The second time it happened, I was probably older, wiser, those sorts of things, but I also recognised that, you know, to come from a place of gratitude and to have had the opportunities that I'd had to work in the game to the level that I did and for the length of time I did, I didn't ever want to lose that sense of it. And really even now, that as difficult and as challenging as that moment was, I'm not sitting here opposite you having this conversation without that experience. And so it's left me with, you know, some of the lessons I now coach too. But it also, in the first instance, I thought that, you know, even coming into this type of work, why would someone want to be coached by someone who was a sack CEO in that sense? And it actually held me back for a while. Again, identity, you know, sense of identity.
So can you talk a little bit about that, around sort of the exit to the struggle with that and your work back to develop that leadership confidence in you, in yourself again?
Yeah. No, when I first finished, I thought that I'd be able to offer something, but I wasn't sure what it actually was, and so therefore I couldn't explain it, and by not being able to explain it, you therefore don't get any work. You know, that's really how it was. And so I puddled around with that for probably 12 or 18 months after I finished at Melbourne Football Club. But then I studied art for a few years, and about, you know, a few years into that, or I think it was probably two or three, I started to get my mojo back a little bit. You know, there might be something a little bit different. And I don't think it was a coincidence that it was having followed a creative pursuit full time, whereas perhaps I looked at my experiences, because I was to do the art that I wanted to do and I wanted to do well, I needed to be some form of expression of who I was, and realising that the experiences I had, the good, the bad, the ugly, all of that was actually part of what you potentially bring, you know, to someone to sit down with them, particularly in leadership roles, that you know, the full gamut of that experience, you know, and I find it much easier to talk about the lessons than I do about the joys. And I don't know if that's I don't know why that's quite the case, because it definitely gave me a lot of joy.
Mm.
But I found probably the things that I coached to were the lessons that came from the moments. I was probably much less introspective in joyous moments than I was in challenging moments. And so that's probably why the lessons came from that. And it's interesting, because I've, you know, a lot of the CEOs I talk to and I coach to, the feedback they often get from their team is, we don't celebrate the wins.
Mm.
You know, and I probably was one of those too often, that, you know, that, and Michael Voss spoke about that in his podcast, and where he said that he had to slow down at that point, because he was probably pretty used to success. You know, yeah. He's a guy who's had a lot of it. But he actually talked about the fact that he was moving on before people were ready to move on. And, you know, something that someone may have worked unbelievably hard to achieve and wanted to be in that moment for longer than he was allowing them to be, by, we've got another game, we've got another training session, we've got another moment, whatever it might have been at the time, was one of the lessons he learned. And I would say, in a lot of the people I work with, that is certainly a thing. Yeah, so and now it's, say, 7 or 8 years into Design CEO, and every year that layers up and layers up, and you'd know yourself, the benefit, I think the currency of our existence is the conversations that we get to have, and whether that's with your kids, whether that's with your friends, whether that's with the work you do, do you get that energy from this discussion, the energy from, you know, leaning forward and go, gee, this is interesting, you know, that sort of idea. The further I've gone in life is that I realise that's the currency, you know. And so if I was measuring the currency of a good organisation, I can almost guarantee they're having good conversations. And I'm not saying they're good as in they're fun, they're joyous, they're whatever. There'll be certainly those, but they're having the conversations they need to be having at the time mm-hmm. when they should be having them, particularly in performance-oriented, you know, yeah. places, which is most, really.
Yeah. And tell me, because with your business, Design CEO, one of those advantages you think you bring as a person and as a team and organisation is that come to play, and you referenced yeah. that before. What does that mean, and why is it the thing that lights you up?
What comes up for you when I say come to play?
I think come to play is about those moments where it's on, whatever that is, and you know, I think about my morning this morning with kids, you know, trying to get them out the door, you know, yeah. their shirts tucked in and wheat bix off their cheeks and all that stuff. That's a parenting moment to me.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to yell and scream and rush and hurry them. I want to do that as the dad I want to be.
Yeah.
So that to me is what I would think about. What are those moments in all the roles I play as a dad, a coach, a consultant, an advisor?
Mm.
What are those moments where it's, okay, this is the time that it's most important, most critical, most impactful, easy or hard, which one do I choose? Mm. That's the way I would look at that.
No, I think it's a great explanation, because a couple of things straight away come to mind. Firstly, that you've got a sense of the dad you want to be.
Mm.
So that's the dad I want to be. And so there are times when parenting will – test the dad you want to be in that, and also actually say, am I just talking about the dad I want to be, or am I actually being the dad I want to be? And often, you know, one of my favourite lines is people don't experience your intentions, they experience your behaviours. So in that moment, are you behaving to the intention? You know, that's the thing I think about. And then you go, but there's still a job to be done here.
Mm.
You know, the kid does need to get out the door. You know, there. And so even I think about there's probably a little bit of prep which has gone into this as well. Like, are you up before the kids? Probably not. The kids get up at whatever time they get up and they look after themselves, do whatever. But at some point, you know, there's some system and structure around this thing as well. You know, there's conversations between yourself and your partner. There's other things which are going on in all of this. I'm sure one of the traps I think everyone falls for when you have more than one kid is you think the second kid's going to be like the first kid, you know, but they're often, they require very different things from you, you know. So each of the kids require you to meet them where they're at, you know, and that asks something different of you. So all of these things that come to play, things for me, that there is an idea around it. There's a philosophy, there's a piece of thinking, this is the conditions we're trying to create here for these kids to live the life that gives them the best chance, the same as any team. But then, you know, I would ideally want you there early, you know, I want you there, you know, 10 minutes before, because we can then do, and we call it Lombardi time. You know, Lombardi time is 10 minutes before, because those little interactions, those little communications, those little connections that we make, those, you know, what you do on the weekend type connections, or, you know, how's your sick kid going connections are really important in terms of, you know, I think of ideas around clarity as an outcome that they come from connection. And then when the, you know, the siren goes, we come to play. You know, we've done the prep. Have you done the work that you should have done coming into this meeting? Have you got your idea at least forming? Are you prepared to articulate that idea? Are we prepared to hold ourselves to a standard in this meeting? Or are we going to be looking at our phones the whole time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever it might be, you frame whatever that thing actually is. And so come to play for me with Design CEO is if you're going to be coached, I've done the work. You know, I then do the follow-up. I create the potential of a conversation. You know, the idea for leaders is this sense of being lonely is really paramount for them. You know, but I might be the reason why they're not alone. They don't have to be alone in this pursuit. And so from that point of view, have I thought about what, you know, am I fully present with them in the coaching sense, and I have a real framing of that, you know. And again, a Rick Rubin, and people might know Rick Rubin, the music producer, he talks about the postures of, am I a sounding board here for this person? And that might be enough. That might be all that they need in that moment. But often it goes deeper than that. So therefore there might be a bit of truth telling in this, as in, have you thought this one fully through? And there may be a way that we now need to have a conversation around that. And then if there is a little bit of truth telling, that normally means that the conversation has now opened up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And normally from that point of view, I go into the idea sharing. It's just sharing ideas. It's never giving advice. Because I think the minute you go into advice giving, you're now a teacher. You're a teller, not a teacher.
Yeah.
It's about coaching here. And so we share some ideas, and then we come to the end of it and we go, well, there's no solution in any of these things. Why don't we partner to try and come up with something? Why don't we just sit in front of a whiteboard with some sticky notes, and you get your ideas out, I get my ideas out, and we work this thing out together in whatever way we can. And so that idea of sounding board, truth teller, idea sharer, partner is come to play. If I can get to the end of a coaching session and I've somehow just gone into advice mode, I've failed that what that person actually needs from me, even though a lot of the time they just want advice, you know,
because
they just want to be able to go and sort this shit out.
Yeah,
you know?
Drowning personal, hang on to anything.
That's a great way of saying it.
Yeah.
And so to actually come to play, and then we've embraced it now as part of Design CEO in terms of our team here, we come to play, you know, we're ready to go. That, you know, that it's got a good energy about it, that we, you know, we've dealt with what we have to deal with by the time we get into the room, but that's also saying we are human, and if someone's really struggling, it's okay to have that conversation. I am really struggling here. Mm-hmm. I'm struggling with the work. I'm struggling with something at home. You know, and you know, you've got Belinda here now. My dog died last year. That was a really sad time for our family, and there were moments where you just go, oh, I'm just not sure I'm really up for it today, you know, and that affected me in a way that I never thought that, you know, that it would. But it's a genuine form of grieving, and so yeah, we just took a little bit of space during that time. You know, all of a sudden the natural order of what's important and what's not important just changed for at least that period of time, and that's okay. And we're all going to go through things, but that's still come to play. You know, come to play might be we're going to set aside that list of priorities on the to-do list just to go, yeah, let's have a chat, let's just talk. That's okay.
Yeah, I mean, you can hear the energy in your voice. So that, I mean, that's palpable about the work. Yeah. I'm interested around you're talking about some pretty sophisticated concepts there around what that means. I mean, you've rattled a whole lot off around being prepared and have we thought about this and what are we bringing and what drives us. All those things are quite sophisticated things for people to be thinking about and work out and can take time. How do people cultivate this in, and I'm thinking, I say leadership, but I mean that in the broader sense of parent, coach, contributing to their community, volunteering somewhere. How do people cultivate that sort of thinking and skill and reflection?
Well, I think the last word's the key one. You are reflecting. You know, Seth Godin's got a wonderful line, busy is the new lazy, busy is the new lazy. And often talk about the two things which hold us up, pull us up. And it probably was a lesson that I got from Barassi, which I don't think he ever taught me, but it's my reflection on the relationship, was the two things that he asked you to step into was fear and also there's this idea of lazy. You know, and I'm not talking about lazy in outworking the issue. I'm talking about lazy as in confronting the things you need to confront in regard to that. So I find, and I think it's quite universal, that as leaders we get into the overthinking space really quickly. We've just got too many, and the overthinking can be called overwhelm, but really it's overthinking. Even if there's a lot of things coming your way, you're really overthinking them. You know, you haven't worked out a sort of a natural order of how you think about them. And so if you're overthinking, if you're underthinking, read, yes. If you're underthinking, go and get more information. If you're underthinking, go and have another conversation. As in, you need more knowledge, you need more information. But there is a limit to that, even though there's no lack of access to it. But then if you're overthinking, right. And so the practice of reflection that almost universally I will talk to is a form of journaling, a form of writing, where you go through a process of sense-making in order to get to meaning-making. So you can't – it's hard to make meaning if you can't make sense. You know, it's hard to make good if you can't make sense. It's hard to make your numbers if you can't make sense. It's hard to make progress if you can't make sense. And so the journaling piece for me is one of really answering the question, what does the role expect of me in this moment? But therefore it goes to a moment, what does this moment expect of me? I just use four words, calm, brave, humble, compassionate. I think they're the four words to come back to. But also a practice of reflection, you know, at the other end is we've had the experience now. What is the feedback from the experience, even the day, even doing this podcast? You know, that we're learning all the time, that we thought we knew the best way of doing it, but we're always growing. And if someone comes in and says, have you thought about it this way? Or that didn't work as well as we thought. So the three questions are then is what happened? You know, let's start a dialogue. You know, information and conversation. And then what now? Let's respond. You know, that's alignment, not agreement. You know, that's we've got to respond to that. And then what next is a conversation about direction. You know, are we on track or are we on the right track? You know, is this we're going down a track which is just not the one right one. And for me, they come out of really even a game. You know, that's the natural reflection of a game of footy. What happened, what now, what next? And sport draws as much as it can from the feedback that the game's just given them, but business doesn't. And so even though they may be sophisticated concepts, they come really with basic frameworks and thinking. You know, if I just, you know, after, you know, we do this podcast, you just sit down and say, well, what happened there? And you might say, gee, there was a really good thing we spoke about. Maybe I can draw on that in the work that I do.
Mm.
Or I'm not sure I'd be going down that track. You know, that doesn't work for me, that one.
Mm.
And so it is that because when we go back to our offices, I can guarantee there will be emails. I can guarantee, you know, there's a little part of us which the first thing we'll do is just check our phones and just see who try to contact us during that time. There's that immediacy around that. And, yes, that needs to be responded to, but how come that takes priority over, you know, an active practice of reflection? And there's a lovely little saying, easy to do, easy not to do.
Mm.
It's really easy to do, but it's actually probably a little bit easier not to do it, you know, in that sense. And so I think of that the same as keeping fit, keeping anything which you think is worthwhile. And we're not asking you as leader. If you've got a non-reflective leader, I can't think how they can lead. It's as basic as that, because they don't know what the world's asking of them or what feedback is coming their way. They're not listening and they're not aware. And you'd want to be pretty bloody smart to actually see your way through the world oblivious to all of those things. And I'm sure there's leaders who do. You know, there's some great examples of that at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think you can't be successful without self-awareness, I don't think, because you keep having those recurring patterns of behaviour that sort of you find your limit fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we get the feedback but we don't want to listen to it.
Yeah, and the feedback, so the danger often is that it goes to weakness rather than blind spots, and I think there's a very, very big difference. I think mostly we're aware of our weaknesses and we can do things at different times to deal with that. So, you know, I know, for instance, listening to the podcast, I speak too much into the conversation, and it's partly because I get excited by the conversation, but I've got to manage my own energy at that time. It's about it's a space for the person here. Yeah. Hang on. It's not about you, you know, that type of thing. And so that's a weakness. It's not a blind spot. I'm aware of it. But I remember getting feedback at Melbourne Football Club at one stage that I was considered intimidating. And if someone had to ask me to write 50 words down on a piece of paper as to how they were experiencing me, I wouldn't have had intimidating on the list.
Mm.
But that's how they were experiencing me. And I can either choose to ignore it and say, well, you guys don't know what you're talking about, all 120 of you, whatever it might have been, you know, when that was the words they came to. Or I can actually say, well, gee, that might be a blind spot because I don't experience myself in those moments. It's how people are experiencing me.
Mm.
And therefore I have to work on that. It's gone from probably now a blind spot to a weakness in that way because I'm aware of it. And therefore these are the things I'm going to work on. Do they help you with that? And if you go back to people and say, these are the three things I'm going to work on, they go, well, that's not exactly what we're talking about. It's a bit more of this, a bit less of that. Okay, and you still have choices in that. It's not, you just don't, you know, you've got to think it through. You know, because it's like a lot of things, people don't necessarily, they know what the issue is or the problem they have. They don't necessarily know what the solution is. You know, they say they don't like it, but they don't have a how to fix it. That's, you know, that's where perhaps a different level of thinking is required, particularly on complex issues such as how people are experiencing you. And so I think the core of all of this is more about building awareness around the blind spot rather than and some people, sometimes we have to knowingly go forward with something which is a weakness, but we know it's not worth the effort to fix it. because it actually would come at the cost of something else potentially as well. That can be a trade-off you make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not gonna spend 20 hours a week getting better at something of which I can employ someone to do, as an example.
Yeah. Yeah. I think generally we're horrendous at feedback, because I think we don't do both sides of it. I don't think we do particularly well. I don't think we receive the positive feedback well. We dismiss that because it's innate in us, or it's something people see, and so we often dismiss and don't hear the positive. And I think sometimes we then dismiss the negative if it doesn't agree with us, as opposed to seeing it as data. And I love that frame blind spot, because I think about a car. Mm. Most modern cars now have that little red light that just says, hey, there's a car there. And if you haven't seen it, it just alerts you to the danger. And all, you know, not everything's dangerous for us as a leader, but it's nice to have that awareness system, I think.
Well,
how do you do that? You mentioned journaling. Is that your preferred method of reflection?
Yeah. No, it is. And it came to me through – I love Adam Grant's work, and I think I've naturally always been someone who's been a writer. I enjoyed writing at school. I like the creative expression of writing. I love storytelling. I think it's just – you know, I think also there's a – even writing as compared with speaking, for example. Like if you're speaking, like you're experiencing me in ways – way different to my words at this stage. You know, when sometimes you read a transcript of something you've said and go, gee, that makes no sense, reading it, you know, after the event. But the words came with expression, it came with body language, it came with nods and, if you see 4 years in a row, that might look ridiculous on a piece of paper, but it can make sense in conversation. And so when we're actually speaking to people, we're weighing up a whole lot of other things. So to clearly articulate a piece of thinking and be able to put it into words which are compelling enough for people, well, you know, there's a very good chance it can be compelling when you speak to it. But I think if we just speak to something which we haven't tried to put into words, and I try to keep my language relatively simple, to be honest, in that I definitely I do look at the structure of how I write, and I tend to use short sentences and really vary length of sentences and things like that, just ways of which I utilise language. But even from a journaling point of view, I can be writing down and I just stop and I go, I've never thought of that before. I've never connected those two ideas before. And that can come out of coaching as well. Like you'll be coaching someone and they go, oh, is that a bit like this? And you go, it's exactly like that.
Mm.
And that's now a piece of wisdom that becomes yours, really, you know, from that point of view. And so the journaling for me is bookending a day, as much as you can. And I'm not saying I do it every day, but I do it most days. And it is the start of the day, two questions, I have a trademark, finding something, and then two questions, what's possible, what's important. And so what's important is really define reality, what's possible is give hope, even in your own day. And then I finish the day with the three questions, what happened, what now, what next. And I try to do that even with my coaching sessions, what happened, what now, what next with the people I coach, or after I've delivered a workshop or something like that as well. Trying to build thinking around that. And part of it is we forget as well. We forget what we were feeling at the time, and to actually put some sort of record of it and be a little bit ritual about it. I do love having nice notebooks, and I've got a nice fountain pen I've used forever and things like that. So there's a bit of ritual around it as well. There's some part of you, I like having headphones on, listening to music, which I've got a journaling playlist. I have that music going. And it's music which, you know, can have a good elevation of mood, you know, stuff I really enjoy. And I think there's part of it which is just making sure you're in the best shape you can be for whatever, you know, day you're going to have. You know, I'm going to be sitting here with you having this podcast. Have I got myself in a good space today so I can bring the best of myself in this time?
Mm. Well, one of the things I've shared with you privately is I admire your ability of seeing the world just for the way it is rather than the way it should be or the way you want it to be, or and have this sense of binary that's right, that's wrong, that's good, that's bad. There's a breadth that you have to your thinking that allows you just to engage with where someone's at. My first question is, do you see that in yourself? And if so, has that been cultivated purposefully? Is that just something that's happened through your experience and upbringing and the people around you?
I think it's probably the 61-year-old version of me in some ways. Mm. And probably there was a lot of that early. We grew up in a environment which was, my grandfather was a trade union person, so there was a sort of a worker's mindset, if you like, look after the workers was always, and my brother actually ends up doing that full time in sport, industrial relations and probably even deep, a lot more deeper than that now. I think the world is tended to be judged in a really binary way, and I would hear people talking about people who I know well as by being either good or bad, hero or villain, or when I was experiencing them as something much more human than that, you know. For even the best people, the most outstanding people, they're making mistakes all the time. And it's the basis by which they're actually making those mistakes. So they're making the mistakes because, you know, they're haven't thought it through is very different to, you know, if someone goes down a track and they make a choice, and like it could be, you know, I've gone and watched players, and because I was a recruiter, and I've judged them as not being good enough, and they've gone on and played 300 games. Mm. Like you've actually, it's just judgment, really. And the world is just judgment based on something which, if there was perfect information, there was perfect knowledge, there was perfect whatever, we don't even have to make a judgment. And so leadership has to embrace ambiguity as at its very heart, because it's the only reason we actually need it in the first place, you know, because if it was right or it was left, and it was clearly right or it was left, like as the world sort of now defines itself in some weird way, that sort of emerged in our lifetime, really. There was definitely preference, but not in the way that it is now. Whereas we know the answer somewhere in between. Mm. We know that. But we it's almost like we take some pride in that it's got to be this way, it's got to be that way. So I'm really strong on having, you know, clear ideas around how philosophically you seek to read and principles which underpin those things. You know, and even I mentioned before in terms of the business, creativity and humanity are two things which will underpin design CEO, because I think leadership's a very human pursuit. You know, it's recognition that we're going to fuck it up is part of the deal here. And we're going to have good days, we're going to have bad days. You know, we're going to have people respond well to us and people who respond poorly to us. We're going to have our own moods, our own good, you know, we step up, and at different times we didn't step up hard enough. You know, all of that stuff's going to happen. And so when I see people being judged as being either one thing or the other, who are at a really high level of what they are, you know, for me that's just, yeah, it's just not real. It's just not how it is. We're all flawed. We're all people working it out. I don't know about you, but I would have thought I had it nailed by now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I would have thought, I think I'm the most curious now than I've ever been. And it might be that the world that I operate in is broad enough for me to have that breadth of curiosity as compared with just being sort of aligned to high-performance sport, as an example. But I've even seen high-performance, because I coach people in high-performance sport. You know, Michael Voss is just an unbelievably curious person. You know, he's just up for any idea that you throw at him. And that's why I think you'll be a terrific coach. Mm. You know, that's part of it. But then there'd be people who would say, oh, Michael's either, he can either do this or that. He's right or he's wrong. He's a good coach, he's a bad coach. That's bullshit, isn't it? You know? So, and it might be, again, just I think a product of the experience of growing up with people who were seen as one thing or the other, and me just finding them as just something in between.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's probably reflective of your lived experience as well, of being judged yourself from a distance, or whether internally or externally, and knowing that, well, that's not completely the whole picture.
No, very much. You know, people would and generally it was because some perception of you. Like if a CEO is in the media, it's normally not for a good reason. You know, there might be a fluff piece at some point, but there's majority of it was we're moving the coach on, or a player's misbehaved, or probably not so much the CEO in those sorts of roles, but certainly traditionally it was. You know, we've got a board problem, or you know, it's an issue which is going to be one which actually requires a relatively stern disposition. You know, and people, the feedback I got more than anything initially was you smile more than I thought you did. You know, I'd never seen you smile before, and I reckon I'm relatively, I like humour. Humour sort of sit, I'm on the cusp. And my family, humour was a big part of it. You know, Christmas parties with the Schwabs growing up, there was just some really funny people in the room. Mm. And, you know, you'd have tears running down your face listening to my Uncle Frank tell stories or whatever it was. That's just how we grew up. But then we had these serious jobs in life. He was a VFL umpire back in the day. It was a serious job. My father was executive commissioner of the AFL, serious job. I'm a CEO, serious job. Peter Schwab was a coach, serious job. My brother in his role, serious job. But they're all really funny people. They just so humour was a big part of it. But no one ever got to see it. So you were judged in this way. Oh, no, he's a very serious young man, you know, whatever it was. So and I probably wasn't.
Mm.
Yeah.
A coach once said to me that leadership is a contact sport. And, you know, you've spoken to it as we've been talking around that ability to show up, come to play, you know, honour the role that's in front of you.
Yeah.
That takes a lot of mental energy to do well.
Mm.
How do you manage your energy, personal psychology around turning up and doing that well?
Well, my first reflection is there are times I didn't manage it well, and I had this thing that I could outwork the problem. That was actually a big part for me. You know, I've been open about it. I've suffered from depression for a large part of my adult life, which I've had, you know, various times where, you know, it got significant and serious. And the weird thing is, and I don't know whether this has actually been dismissive, so I'm prepared to say it. I almost call it a bit of a gift in some ways, because I think it forced me in the first instance, you know, there's a little line I like is we repeat what we don't repair. We repeat what we don't repair. And I had some repairing to do.
Mm.
I was 24, I was the CEO of an AFL club, taking on way more than perhaps I should have, but never wanting the world to think that's what it was. And I was very underdeveloped probably in all the areas that you naturally are underdeveloped at that time, and people might think of you as some sort of prodigy because you were given the job, but I was definitely not. And so that gift of depression was the thing which actually it forced me to go deep in order to go forward, and going into a deeper place and being prepared to go to the deeper place was then the understanding that, yeah, it's a contact sport, but, you know, we can all take a bump. You know, we can all take, you know, the knocks that it's going to give, but every so often you're going to get a headshot. Someone's going to take a cheap one at you. Someone's going to kick you when you're lying on the ground.
Mm.
Someone's gonna see an opportunity when you're in that place of vulnerability, just to, like the old days, to give you a bit of a whack at the back of the head when you're the real chip. That's there for it. And I say that not as someone who's judging on that, because I think there are times I did that as well. That, you know, there were times where I would look back on some of my own behaviours in those moments as being driven by something other than the better part of me in that way. But I reckon it always come at a cost to me more than it come at a cost to the other person, because it was those reflections which I go, that's, I'm being something other than what I think is the good person here. And it's interesting because even when people ask me about being the young CEO, if someone had just said to me in a really simple way, just be a good person, Cameron, you'll be okay. If that was the one thing I committed to, but that was just not in the minds of anyone at that time, and it certainly wasn't in mine, that I had to be a certain thing. And in some ways try to create an identity, which I then did my best to try and fit into, and it exhausted me, and I got very unhealthy as a result of that. But since, and probably the practice of reflection and all these things, is I've done the work, and most of the time the contact element of it has been replaced with a sort of a sense of forgiveness, really, in some ways. I'm not a naturally vindictive person. I've got no want for reprisal or anything like that. I've got no energy for those things, which from time to time probably made me a little bit of a soft target, you know, in that sense.
Those times, I mean, that's obviously a very dark time and a really acute example of it, but setback, struggle, it's inevitable in leadership.
Yeah.
Do you have allies who helped you through that? I mean, not just allies in terms of people around you, but those truth tellers. And how did you find them? How did you seek them out? And what was that relationship like for you?
They're probably more than allies. They're probably heroes in lots of ways. Everybody needs a hero, I reckon. And hero is a very amplified word, and it probably comes from maybe my love of sport, my love of music. You know, they're very amplified figures, people in those worlds, even in art as well. Yeah, you know, some of the most, you know, one of the things which is always challenging is when one of your favourite artists, you learn later, it wasn't a good person, say, you know, or at least that's how some person in history has described them. And so I think there's a need to have people, and coaching builds on this sort of idea, if you like, people who will have great integrity for you. It comes from a place of, you know, genuine care, genuine love, and it's not, and I use love probably a little bit more loosely than in that sense, but even someone like a Barassi, I felt it came from a place of love, you know, that there was, you know, he cared at a deeper level. And then they need to have an insight, which is actually helpful. Like I've got a loving family, even though we've had certainly our challenges along the way. My family, my parents divorced when I was in my teens, and that was really challenging at the time. But I felt they both loved me, and they loved my brother and my loved the sister, and there's a lot of love between the three of us as well. So there's integrity in those relationships. In terms of insight, well, that could be variable. You know, it depends on what you're dealing with. Like I remember having a conversation with my sister at one stage saying, I have to take this group through this process of development all over again. And she's a prep school teacher and she says, I have to do that every year. Yeah, that's part of what I have to do. So her insight was really helpful. But to have people who have integrity for you and insight, which is actually helpful, and people might call it a personal board. You know, you could have, I'm trying to think what Lane Beachley's, she had a group name that she called it in her podcast, her dream team, that's right, her dream team. To have those people in you, and there are times where your first instinct in, unfortunately, when you're going through sort of mental health, or often when you're going through mental health, is to isolate yourself, and I definitely did that at different times, but I've learnt not to since. And I'm also fortunate. I've got a very good friend, Craig Cameron, who's been my oldest friend. Well, he's also made a career in the game as well. So we can have those conversations, the integrity insight conversations. I'm not sure what our relationship would have been different if we'd both gone into totally different worlds. But we can talk about issues as it relates to our family, but also issues as it relates to what it's like to survive the games of which we've aligned our careers to, you know, even though I'm less that now. So I'd say to people, try and have someone in your life who can tick those boxes, the integrity one and the insight one. And they just end up being almost hero figures. And everybody needs a hero. And, you know, one of my first ever heroes is a wonderful fellow, Francis Burke, played at Richmond, great player. And my dad sort of gave me a different insight into his special qualities growing up. And it was about 12 months ago. I rang him as I was leaving Melbourne. Our main home's up in Daylesford, and I rang him as we were leaving Melbourne, and I've pulled into the driveway in Daylesford, and I'm still talking to Francis Burke an hour and a half later. Yeah. And he's now a guy in his 70s, and we're having these wonderful conversations. And I would sense that he has great integrity for me. I think he'd be that sort of person with, you know, lots of me's, if you like, but there was also insight. He's a very curious, you know, caring, you know, will challenge me on conversations and will go deeper into some of the thinking. And, you know, he's quite a religious fellow, and I'm not, but you can tell there's a deep philosophical sort of view that he has that that guides him in one way or another.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah.
Anais Nin said that we don't see things as they are, we see them as we are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there something we haven't talked about yet, that a lesson that you've got from leadership and living leadership that we haven't discussed?
There's probably a lot. There is you touched on it before, this concept of honouring the role, if you like, because it's not about you. As much as it feels as though it's about you, you know, whether it's the title, the car park, the corner office, whatever it might be. And so this sense of responsibility which comes with it, that it's all on you but it's never about you, if in walking away from 25 years of CEOing, if someone had asked me what's the number one thing you've learned, I don't think I could have answered it, but I could actually answer it now, and I think it is that it's all on you but it's never about you. And so even in walking away from the game and getting sacked in as a CEO, it still wasn't, even though the press conference was there for me, it's not about me. It's about the Melbourne Football Club, which has managed to drag itself through 170-odd years. So it can never be about. I'm just one of the people who just, you know, had the baton in my hand for a period of time and dealt with it in ways which will always, you know, I won't always be judged, but would certainly were up for judgment at that time. And so to actually recognise that the humility associated with that, when every force that actually is coming your way is making it feel as though it's about you, would be a core lesson of the game. And if I was to reflect, you know, even on to the phases of your development as a leader, I think there's a period of time where you need to be ambitious to get good enough at the thing that enables you to do the job to the best, to what it actually asks of you at that time. And hopefully doing it in a way which might be better than someone else can do it. You might be the best version of that. Mm-hmm. And then at some stage you transition where you realise it's not about you. And then it's actually now about creating the conditions for others to go into, you know, the wisdom rather than, you know, it builds on, you know, the conditions you create for others and those sorts of things. And so you're not ambitious anymore, but you still have ambitions for. It's ambitions for the organisation. It's ambitions for the people. It's ambitions, you know, for those who are yet to even step in the door yet, because if they get to step in the door, they get the ability to, or they get the opportunity to fulfil the best of their own ambitions. And so I really love that idea. It's all on you. So the responsibility sits with you, but it's never about you. It's not about you. Mm. Yeah.
I love that. What's something, as we start to close, what's something in your career that you wished someone had have told you early that would have made a real difference?
Probably touched on it a little bit before. Just be a good person.
Mm.
Just be a good person. You know, I'm going to be a great deal maker. I'm going to be a great strategist. I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be someone who knows more about this specific piece of technical understanding than anyone's ever walked this earth. Whatever it might be, that's okay. And I think there was probably times where I might have been a little bit ahead of the game just for a minute, on a couple of pieces of thinking, but that lasted for about 0.2 of a second, you know, and it was just circumstance and situation or luck that I come across something, whatever it might be. But if someone just said, just be a good person, Always. That it just seems to me that will always serve you well. I deliberately don't say great, you know, because I think we get to visit great just as a really, you know, for you shake hands with it and then it walks away. You know, you might have those moments, but we get to visit average a fair bit as well, and hopefully don't get to shake their hand for very long. But just this idea of just being consistently decent, good, caring, friendly, generous, grateful. I think they're the words which are important, you know. Like goodness is one of the values of Design CEO, just goodness. It comes from a good place, best part of ourselves, the humanity piece, yeah. We also have grouse as one of our values as well, which is we want to do it perhaps pretty bloody, you know, we want the work to be something that you go, yeah, that was grouse, you know. So that idea just simply of try to be a good person, that was the one which I look at now, and I don't think that meant that I ever did not try to be a good person, but it was just such a simple, clean way of thinking.
Thank you. It's been a grouse conversation. I hope it served you, and I hope it served the listeners, but it's been awesome speaking with you, so thanks.
Oh, and thank you, Andrew. I know that the work you do is really special, and I know that I've enjoyed every conversation. There's I've got one of the little things in life when someone puts a head around the corner and you're always pleased to see them. You're definitely that. Or someone, you look down at your phone and it's a certain number that person ringing, you know the number, or you know, obviously we don't need to know the number now, but and you just look at it and go, I'm looking forward to this chat. And that's the conversations I've had with you. So thanks very much.
No worries. Thank you.
Cheers.